Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today it's my pleasure to introduce an actor, writer, and musician by the name of V-Tran. He lives in Kansas City, but the journey he's taken to get here began in Vietnam. It also includes a childhood spent living as a refugee in Garden City, Kansas. V-Tran's new play, The Butcher's Son, explores that journey and more. Thanks so much for stopping by the studio this morning, V.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Gina.
A lot of people who know your work think of you primarily as a musician, the frontman for V-Tran Band. And we'll talk about your music a little bit later, but what inspired you to take this turn to write a play about the immigrant experience?
Well, I went to school for theater, and I actually started out. I've been here in Kansas City about a decade, but probably for the first 5 years I was in Kansas City, I was actually primarily known as an actor, and no one knew that I was a musician. And then about 4 years ago, I released my first EP, and now people primarily know me as a musician instead of a theatrical artist. But they say that you spend your whole life writing that first album or book or whatever, and it's been that way for me, being born in the shadow of Saigon, Vietnam, and raised in cattle country of Garden City, Kansas. I've kind of had a two-part album that I've been working on my whole life.
And yeah, I've heard you talk about wheat fields and sea salt.
Yeah, so I say because of that experience, I'm this dichotomy. I'm equal parts sea salt and wheat fields. And the wheat fields part of me, the American heritage that I grew up with, is evident in my in the V-Tran Band's latest full-length album, American Heroine, which is kind of my homage to the great American authors that inspired me growing up. And the other half of that narrative, the spiritual companion, is about to come to life, and that's The Butcher's Son, and that's about my Vietnamese heritage and my family's journey escaping Vietnam and going through Khmer Rouge-controlled Cambodia, the refugee camps of Thailand and the Philippines, and then finally arriving in southwestern Kansas and my family scraping to build a life here.
When did you and your family leave Vietnam?
We left in 1981, just as I was old enough to travel, and it took us 2 years.
How old were you?
I was about one, yeah. I was born in 80, at about the age of one, they carried me out of there, and it took us 2 years to finally make it to America.
What were the conditions that triggered their departure?
Well, you know, my sister, my older sister, who's 8 years older than me, was born in 72 in the middle of the war. And they all survived. My parents survived. My sister survived. And they tried to make a go of it, you know, and it was just tough going. And so when I was born, that was kind of the catalyst that convinced them, you know, there's no way that we're going to try to raise two kids here and deny them the opportunities that would be possible for them elsewhere, you know. So we gotta make a break for it.
You talked about a journey with many different phases that you went through: Cambodia, Thailand, the Philippines. How long did it take you and your family to arrive here in the United States?
2 years. We traveled north out of Vietnam into Cambodia, and my family had to stop in Phnom Penh for a while because of the Khmer Rouge activity and just bandits and just unsafe travel conditions in general. And so we waited there for a while until our guide told us it was safe to move on. And then we journeyed to the Cambodian border. The goal was to reach a refugee camp run by the Red Cross in Thailand. And it was right there on the border that we were captured by the Khmer Rouge. Just a stone's throw away from the camp. Like, the camp was visible from where we were.
Oh, my gosh.
But through, I don't know, some might say divine intervention, some might say humanitarian shrewdness, and others might say just pure coincidence. But, you know, I can't judge that. I can just shrug and say that it happened. But we were bartered for by the Red Cross and released by the Khmer Rouge.
Wow. And, but so in Vietnam, your parents knew that there was this refugee camp and that help was awaiting them in this place?
Yes. All the Vietnamese refugees who were intending on escaping the country, they knew the different targets to shoot for. A lot of the Vietnamese folks went by way of sea, and you'll know them by the popular term Vietnamese boat people. And they would just crowd onto a makeshift rafts or bribe pirates to mercenary pirates to take them aboard. Our family weren't boat people. We went by land.
So you left Vietnam at the age of one. It took 2 years. This is sort of in that gray area where most people don't remember anything from that time in their lives, but it's possible. Do you remember anything from this journey?
Yeah, I have one memory, and that's how I got this scar here on the right side of my forehead. And I got that in the refugee camps, and psychologists call that a light bulb memory or a flash bulb memory. It's because it was a traumatic event.
Oh, interesting. So, but and you have a physical reminder, which would make it, I guess, also very hard to forget.
Absolutely, yeah.
What is the sort of flashbulb memory? Do you remember the incident?
Oh, sure. And this will all be in the play. So,
No problem.
No need to worry about spoilers. It just all enriches, everyone's understanding of it. But I joke about, people ask me how I got the scar, and I joke about it, and I say, oh, well, I took a mortar and nam, there's a piece of shrapnel lodged in between my skull and my brain, or other silly stories like that. But I got the scar the same way most kids get scars, and that was doing something I wasn't supposed to be doing. I was horsing around on our little bed in the refugee camp, and there was a concrete floor, and I was hopping around the bed wearing my dad's flip-flops. And so my mom yelled at me. She said, take those off. You're going to hurt yourself, wise as mothers are. And so I did. Dad kept the flip-flops at the end of the bed. But instead of taking them off and getting off the bed and placing them where Dad kept them, I hopped over with the flip-flops on. I took them off, and I hurled them down at the ground. And so the momentum carried me headfirst onto the concrete floor. And I think my mom even said, like, serves you right, but then I didn't move. And then the blood just started pooling on the ground. And she screamed, and my father ran in, and he grabbed me, and he carried me all the way across the camp to the medic station, where they stitched me up, I believe, 8 stitches without anesthetic. And I cursed in every language I knew at the time. But yeah, no, I remember very vividly just in like broad brush strokes, but very, very clearly, the sunlight and my dad carrying me and my blood as it gushed onto the ground as it sped underneath me.
Well, when you talk about this, when you describe these first 3 years of your life in broad brush strokes, I think for me and probably for a lot of people, you think this isn't a childhood that I could even begin to recognize as childhood.
Right.
But when you describe this story, it's kind of like kids are kids on some level. How do you feel about just your ability to relate to a universal kind of childhood experience when your childhood experience was so particular?
Well, and I think that's kind of at the heart of this play. I mean, I am narrating an autobiographical journey that's very specifically Vietnamese-American, but it's also human. It's the human condition, and the play focuses as much about our journey as it does about family and how family stories become family legend, and how you're sitting around a table and you're talking to your mom and you're talking to your sister and you're like, oh, remember that story? And mom interjects, no, that's not how that went. You're getting the story wrong, and everybody chimes in. And, that could be an Italian mother or a Greek mother or, a Jewish sister. That's just how we communicate with each other as family. And to your point, to your question about childhood, it's plain tough being a kid. Yes, there were very specific things that made it tough for me being a kid. Racial slurs on the playground, that feeling of alienation and separation, that feeling of being the quote unquote the other, different from my classmates. But listening to it here kind of in a conceptual manner, all kids feel that way. Childhood is tough, no matter who you are.
Well, I want to hear more about your childhood in a second, but I want our listeners to know that they are listening to V-Tran, who is a local artist. He's a musician, an actor, and he has a new play coming up called The Butcher's Son. And V-Tran, how did you and your parents and your sister find your way specifically to Garden City, Kansas?
Well, it's funny. In the refugee camp, basically, it's like a holding cell or a holding pen of humanity. They're just so many people there just waiting for amnesty, waiting for someone in another country to pay their way to safety. And so my maternal side of the family, they got sponsored to Australia. And that's exactly what we wanted to do. We wanted to follow them and keep what little was left of our tattered family together. But there was no room left at the inn. There were no more sponsorships to Australia. And my parents pleaded with them and they said, you know, please, you know, we're not asking for much. You know, how could there be no more room in Australia? There's so much room, you know,
Australia,
so much land.
Huge.
It's huge. The land is huge. You know, we're not asking for much. And just kind of out of thin air, my dad made an offhand plea, offhand comment of, you know, we don't want much. We'll do anything. We'll be farmers. And the clerk's eyes lit up and said, well, there's farmland in America. And so they shipped us to Wichita, Kansas.
Wow. And how did you go from Wichita to Garden City?
So we showed up in Wichita, Kansas, and there were not a lot of farm plots available to just be snatched up.
Especially not in Wichita.
Not in Wichita.
It's a big city.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And so my parents scraped by just doing whatever they could find, detailing cars, cleaning out apartments, you know, and they would be thrilled at the end of the day if they had enough money to buy a Big Mac, you know, or just junk food or something, you know. Mom would take rice and pour some soy sauce onto it and roll it up in a little egg-shaped ball and say, honey, look, it's an egg. Look, a treat, you know. And so it was tough. It was tough. But that was about the time when the big meatpacking boom of the early, mid-80s happened with these enormous meatpacking plants opening up in Emporia and Dodge City and Liberal and Holcomb, Kansas. And Holcomb is just a few miles out of Garden City. And so a friend of my dad's said that they were going to trek out there and try to get jobs at the meatpacking plant near Garden City. So my dad went with them and he got the job. And he went back on the weekends and brought money to us in Wichita. And then after a few weeks, a few months, something like that, my mom went out with him and she got a job too. And so then the whole family relocated to Garden City. And I was about four at the time. And so three or four. And that's where I ended up growing up. I stayed there until I graduated high school.
Did you know English when you arrived?
No.
What was that like?
Honestly, I was the lucky one. I was a kid. I was that age where I just soaked it up like any other kid. And so it wasn't an impediment for me. And I guess that was the whole point. That's what my parents wanted for me. For them, it was tough. They learned rudimentary English, yes and no, in the camps to prepare them to get to America. And then they learned from there. They still speak with broken English, and so does my sister. My sister was a tween when she arrived, and so it was very,
very tough age.
Very tough for her. And considering she was dropped into the American school system in middle school, essentially, and while that's tough enough to try to learn a language at that age, you have to bear in mind that she lost crucial years of school age.
Yeah.
In the jungles of Southeast Asia. It's not like she was in school back in Vietnam before she came here. I mean, there were 3 years where, you know, from probably like, well, if I do the math, like 9, 10, 11, those years of education were lost to her. And so she had a lot of catching up to do and a lot of struggles there, and yet still gave of her time. She was the one, while my parents were busy working, she was the one who sat down and was like, V, read to me. You know, we had the book it club, the book it reading club at school, and you would vie for a pizza party or whatever, and you could win a pizza party reading like a dozen books or 15 books, 20 books, something like that. And my sister would sit there and listen to me read and sign off on the books that I read to the tune of like over 200 books. Like, I won a pizza party with over 200 books because my sister took the time to do that in the midst of her own struggle.
That's amazing. Do you remember having thoughts and feelings about what it was she was experiencing and what it was she was doing at the time? Or is that the adult reflecting back?
That's the adult reflecting back. No, as a kid, I was like, hey, I drew this book about dinosaurs. I'll sell it to you for $1, you know? And,
yeah.
And she bought it and she still has it somewhere. No, but when I was born, my parents said to her, this is your baby brother. You are responsible for him. You will take care of him. And so growing up, she was like a second mother to me. And she took that very seriously and with such great generosity. But to me, she was just like big sis and second mom. So, you know, we got into our sibling squabbles plenty, but she was always the more patient and generous and graceful about it.
What was it like for you growing up there in Garden City? KCUR's Harvest Public Media recently did a series of stories from Garden City called In the Shadows of the Slaughterhouse, and they're stories about young people from around the world growing up in this Kansas town with parents working at the meatpacking plant. Young people with lots of ambition, determined to live lives that don't involve late nights working in the slaughterhouse.
Yeah, absolutely. No, yes, there was an element of, okay, I'm Vietnamese and most of my classmates are Caucasian or Hispanic. But you know, Garden City, and I think for the majority of the meatpacking towns in Kansas, they really, I don't know if embrace is the right word, but they said, okay, this is the way it is now. So this is our population, and it's a diverse population. And so, yeah, that's okay. You know, I remember growing up, by the time I was in high school, the, you know, city hall and government buildings, they would have signs in English, Spanish, and Vietnamese, you know. And so there was a concentrated effort by the community to be like, okay, this is our population, and we'll serve that population. And so,
and that's
at least
certainly
that was
not
cool.
The stereotype of Kansas when people think of Kansas.
No, I, you know what? I loved growing up in Kansas. I mean, you know, as I've grown up and my ideologies may have strayed a bit from my neighbors, but the fact of the matter is, I grew up around so many good-hearted people, you know, and not a lot of duplicity there. I mean, you see what you get, you know, and they're true and they're honest, you know, and even if we agree or don't agree these days about matters that are impolite to bring up at the dinner table, you know, I'll forever...
Religion, politics, that kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah, that stuff. I'll always forever be indebted to the folks I grew up around in Garden City, Kansas, because they shaped who I am, you know?
What did your parents do there?
My mom and my dad worked in the beef packing plant. And then several years after they started, my father actually left to become a minister. A Southern Baptist minister.
That's an unusual trajectory.
Yeah, so I was a preacher's kid. No, they grew up with secular lives. You know, they didn't really practice any religion, but they found their faith in the refugee camps, and so they didn't grow up with it, and they weren't indoctrinated by it. They didn't inherit it; they chose it. Of their own free will in adulthood, and so they had the same approach with me. I grew up in a conservative household, a religious household, but with the most permissive of parents. They said, we got to choose our lives, and so should you. You know, make your own choices, discover for yourself. Yeah, no, they're awesome. But Dad, because a ministry sponsored us over, and Dad kind of went through his own Saul of Tarsus experience, his own Jean Valjean reclamation of his life, he decided that that it was his calling, his vocation, to go into the ministry. And so he spent the rest of his life using that ministry to sponsor other Vietnamese families over to the United States. And then he would help them get established here in the States, get them jobs, get them schooling so that they could apply for citizenship, as we did, and just get them settled.
You must have met so many people, given where you grew up, the path that your life took, and then also that your father and your parents continued to sponsor other families in similar situations. You must have met so many people with incredible stories of leaving places under unbelievable conditions and significant danger. Was that such a common storyline that it maybe even seemed normal to you?
Yeah, really. I mean, when I talk to my Caucasian friends and I say, yeah, this happened, and, you know, they're like, oh, I never knew. Oh, my goodness. You know, and they're so shocked. And for me, it's so commonplace because that's part of you know, the diasporic Vietnamese American experience. And not to say that our story isn't unique or that any family story isn't unique, but that's kind of what led me to frame, you know, The Butcher's Son as a performance memoir the way that I did. You know, it's both very specific and universal because of that.
When you met other people, is there anyone who you remember who sticks in your mind and you wonder about to this day?
Yeah, there was a guy in the camps, and I regret to say that I don't have a memory of him, but my mom has told me stories that his name was Un, which in Vietnamese means chubby. So he was this big, jolly guy, but he would come by our little hut every morning. He's like, "Where's my little nephew? You know, it's time to go to work." And so he would take me around the camps. He would take me around the camps, and we would just do a little song and dance routine, you know, and I'd do imitations of the refugee camp soldiers and guards, and he would tell stories or sing songs or do comedy routines. But then sometimes he would also spin these long, epic poems about the hardships of war and of refugee life and stuff that would break people's hearts. And even though all of us were destitute, you know, our little two-man show, I guess, gave some hope and some comfort to the other refugees in the midst of their despair. And so they would actually give us what little food they could spare.
That's a very early first theatrical experience.
Yeah.
And a pretty poignant one.
Yeah.
Once you were in Garden City, and there are kids from other parts of the world who are there kind of for similar reasons that you and your family were there, but then there are also the people who have been in Kansas for a long time. How did these kids all interact with one another, with you?
Like going back to the whole issue of just adolescence is hard and childhood is hard. The one thing that I really hung on to a lot that just made childhood really difficult for me was probably self-inflicted. You know, it was, I'm different and there's no getting around it, you know. And other people too. I mean, yes, the racial slurs and the jokes and all of that stuff didn't help. It didn't help. But that's why, you know, some people wonder why, oh, okay, well, you know, like The Great Gatsby or whatever. Why would a Vietnamese kid love The Great Gatsby? And I'm like, why would he not? It's about old rich versus new rich. It's about no matter what you do and no matter what you accomplish, you will never be us. You know, that theme, you know?
Yes.
But I think that that's true of kids. You know, kids will always find a reason to pick someone out of the pack, you know?
Just the idea that as a human being, that you are supposed to only like things based on what would appeal to a Vietnamese American, as opposed
right.
to liking things just based on your own human impulses.
Right. Well, and, you know, we all then let society around us pigeonhole us and throw us into these roles, and even families. I mean, you know, I grew up falling in line with the whole stereotypical Asian kid stereotype, and so it was.
What do you mean by that?
Oh, I don't know. Could it be get straight A's and play musical instruments and get academic scholarships and go to an Ivy League school? But that's where my narrative changed, because, you know, during high school I lost my 4.0, and I thought my life was over. You know, no Ivy League school of my choice, no law school or med school, you know. And so that was at that point where I started to really find my identity. And it was the arts that helped me find my identity, because I said, you know what, if my life is over now because I've lost my 4.0, I might as well do what I want. And so I went out for a play and I started a band and I started doing those things. And it was, you know, it was through my exploration. What the arts allowed me to do was seek truth and be honest with myself. And being an actor, your body is your instrument. And so I had to come to terms with that. I'm never not going to be a 5'4" Vietnamese person. This is the one instrument that I have, you know. And so I better get used to it, and I better be okay with it, you know. And it was through that I was like, you know what, it is okay to be who I am.
That's kind of what I wanted to know, is about when and how the arts first became such a passion for you. And you just mentioned that your body is the only instrument you have, but yet you have picked up other instruments. Can you
Sure.
talk a little bit about just sort of your first encounters with music and with performance?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, performance was just something that I picked up as a lark, but also because I was that, well, I was this complicated combination of, complicated makes it sound overly complicated, but I was a kid who was actually a shy bookworm, nerd, introvert.
This sounds familiar.
But I had a big mouth. You know, and so my big mouth got me into a lot of trouble. And so I was just like so awkward. And so the performing arts kind of gave me a chance to be like, okay, let's shake out some of that awkwardness. Let's learn how to behave around people. And, you know, if you can't be the star quarterback, then you can be, you know, the guy that makes people laugh or the guy that can touch people with stories. And so that's what the arts were able to do for me.
I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to Central Standard, and this conversation with V. Tran, whose play A Butcher's Son opens this weekend, will continue after a short break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with V. Tran. He's a musician, artist, performer of all kinds, an actor, playwright. We're going to talk to him about all of that during the rest of this conversation. But V, when did you arrive in Kansas City?
I was brought to Kansas City by the Unicorn Theater in 2004. I was in grad school at Kansas State University, studying for my master's in directing at the time. But the Unicorn was doing a show by Richard Greenberg called Take Me Out, and it had just won Best Play, and it was making its regional premiere at the Unicorn. And in the play, they needed an Asian baseball pitcher. And so here I was. I went out and I auditioned for it, and I got
it. That's so funny, too, because you mentioned not being like the first picked for athletic teams and stuff.
Right.
And now you're a pitcher.
Right. I had to learn to pitch. Oh, I did my best. I did my best. I apologize to my pitching coach, but I did my best. yeah, you know, but that's the another thing. I mean, continuing what we talked about before, the arts forced me to stretch, you know, my comfort zones. Here I was.
New identities.
Yeah. Here I was, this kid who thought I was the shrimp and, you know, uncool and whatever. And it's like, okay, you're playing a pitcher now. You're going to study all of the Japanese pitchers who have joined the MLB and study their throwing motions and all this other stuff. And I would have never done that on my own. But here it was. I got to explore my body. And when you encounter different roles like this, you do. You explore your body. You explore your voice. You explore other people's journey. And so it expands your mind and your horizons. But yeah, anyway, that brought me to Kansas City. And I spent an entire summer here, and I just fell in love with it.
What did you fall in love with specifically?
There was this brimming electricity I could see. It was an art scene on the rise, theatrically, musically, visual arts, everything. And so I went back and finished grad school, and I thought, you know, unless something crazy, magical falls out of the sky, you know, wouldn't Kansas City be a wonderful place to cut my teeth and get some credits and build up my resume? And so I moved out here in 2005, walked into town, got a job as a singing cabaret waiter at Bar Natasha, run by Missy Koontz and J.D. Mann. And they kind of sheltered me and mentored me as I made the rounds auditioning for everything. You know, I got signed with an agency and started auditioning for commercials and voiceovers and training videos. And
you do have a very nice voice.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. then I started auditioning for shows and getting cast. And then just as I was building my career, it seemed serendipitous that Kansas City's art scene was going through a renaissance. You know, First Fridays was really starting to catch on and explode. And just the level of artistry in all the different artistic disciplines was rising. And you saw something that that it really takes kind of a cultural threshold to happen. And that was, enough was happening commercially, within small businesses, within development, that people were staying. Young people were staying. It was not just
a launching pad.
Exactly, exactly. And so you were starting to see, I mean, there are people in all walks of life. I mean, there are exceptions, but you started seeing just a whole group of young people saying, you know what? with the way that the world exists now and with the technology available to us now, maybe we don't have to go to New York to have a life in theater. Maybe we don't have to go to Nashville to have a life in music. Maybe we don't have to go to Silicon Valley to run a startup business. Maybe we get to choose where home is and who our family consists of.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your music. You have a band, V-Tran Band. When did you get that band together?
It was right about the time that, I like to say that there are several different phases to an artist's life, and the way that I term phase one is proving to yourself you belong. You know, you're fresh out of school and you're wondering, did I make a colossal mistake with my life? So can I prove to myself that I belong in this chosen vocation? And so over the course of several years, you know, I was getting work. And so I said, yeah, I proved to myself I belong. So what's next? And phase two is, well, what do you have to say? And as an actor, as I mentioned before, it's amazing inhabiting someone else's skin, you know, and learning about them and trying to bring that to life on stage. But at some point, you're articulating someone else's story. And I knew that I had my own stories to tell. And the easiest way for me to do that at that point was through music. I'd been writing songs and I had a band in college and all of that. And so I had a collection of an album, a couple albums worth of material. And I said, okay, now it's time for me to tell my stories.
Well, American Heroine is your most recent album, right?
Yes.
There's this very nerdy literary part of me that loves all of the literary references.
Oh, we make it a drinking game when we play in the clubs. You know, I say every time you hear an allusion or a quote, quoting of a great American author, take a drink.
Well, that is so wild, though, because there's always, I think there's this cultural assumption people tend to make, which is that if you know about some of this stuff, then you're possessing some kind of special knowledge and you need to be kind of, you know, gentle about the idea that maybe other people don't recognize it. But you make it a drinking game in bars. That means there are plenty of people out there who recognize literary allusions.
Absolutely, they do.
Well, so I guess, though, part of what I want to get at here is that this album is full of these references to great American authors, and your work has not been strictly about your own personal life experience. You have a lot of very broad source material, and you did grow up in Kansas. You're a whole human being. Is there anything you'd like to set up for our listeners before they hear American Heroine?
Sure. Yeah. No, I think American Heroine was kind of inspired by the whole trope or archetype of the Hemingway hero, the stoic man of that generation. And you know what? In a lot of ways, my father was that man, you know, and most of my childhood and lots, you know, fathers and sons can relate to this, whatever race they are. You know, there's that whole father and son dynamic, you know, living up to the following the footsteps of your father. And in a way, this is my rebuttal to the Hemingway hero. You know, it's showing, you know, the vulnerability that can exist in being a man and the relationship between gender dynamics and like, it's okay. You know, you don't have to be burly, you know, you can be sensitive, but it's becoming self-aware.
Let's listen to American Heroine by V-Tran Band.
Like dear Daisy.
Okay, that's American Heroine. I've heard in there some Steinbeck, Fitzgerald, and Hemingway references. So we talked about that, but who are the other musicians performing here with you?
Oh, the V-Tran band, our core band, consists of Katie Gilchrist on vocals, along with myself, Sean Hogue on lead guitar, Ben Byard on bass, Jared Rivers on drums. And then for that recording and the album, we also enlisted some ringers from the Kansas City music scene, Mark Lowry on piano and organ, Herman Mahari on jazz trumpet, Christine Gross from David George and a Crooked Mile on cello, Christine Grossman, principal violist for the KC Symphony, and Rachel Gaither from Tullamore on violin.
How did you meet all of these people who eventually became your collaborators that you are reaching from across media, across disciplines?
A lot of late nights in clubs around Kansas City, you know, and you know, the shared love of music, you know. I'd go to their gigs and they'd come to my gigs as I was striking out as a solo musician. And I just, I found this amazing tribe, this amazing family.
Well, I want to listen to a very different song now. It's not different so much in sound as in subject matter. This one's Girl at the Bakery, and it tells a story. So we'll hear the whole thing, and people will hear the story. But why don't you go ahead and set it up for us?
Sure. In November 2007, my mother, my father, my sister, and I finally made that return home to Vietnam. I could go there any point in my life, and it'd just be a vacation. But to be able to go back with my family, you know, that's full circle. And so I remember walking the streets with my dad, and he pointed out a street mechanic roughly my age. And he said, you know, for no better reason than his parents made a different decision, not the right or wrong decision, but a different decision than your parents. That could be you.
Well, let's go ahead and hear Girl at the Bakery.
Last month, my parents told me, pack your things, get ready. We're gonna take you home. I took a flight across the sea to see the man that I might be in my land of birth, my father country. Well, sweet Saigon, all of us were wrong, but let us in. The plane touched down, I was calm. Each tree could have been California palm, but everyone around looked just like me, looked just like me. A pretty girl at the bakery, she laughed and said that I spoke funny as she handed me my sweets, oh my sweets. I smiled back, but my tongue was heavy, thinking slow, coconut and honey. And already I wanna go home, wanna go home. The sweets are gone, well maybe I was wrong, but let me in, lead me on. Day she'd be there, my Miss Saigon with the blackest hair and a bag of sweets waiting for me. And she'd ask me, brother, please, what's it like across the sea? Now, is there a chance that you take me with you? Take me with you. Well, I'm not naive that this is love, but there's no telling what we could make of it. All I need is a chance, is a chance. There's nothing for to keep me here anymore. Take me in, make me yours.
day to my blue-eyed love who'd been waiting. Sister, please understand that I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. And I don't know who owes who, but I wish the very best for you. Every day at the bakery, at the bakery. Sweet Saigon, everything is wrong. It's a sin that you're gone. It's a sin that you're gone. It's a sin that you're gone.
That was V-Tran's Girl at the Bakery, and we've heard that that was based on a trip to Vietnam that he took with his family in 2009. And V, in that song, you use the line, I don't know who owes who. What do you mean by that?
Well, it was actually 2007.
2007,
yeah, no problem. I don't know who owes who. Here it was, I encountered this girl who was like, take me with you, you know, get me out of Vietnam. And you know, because of life and because of circumstances, you know, that just wasn't a possibility, you know. And that was kind of my tacit apology to her. We weren't involved in the war, you know. We were dealing with the consequences of it, you know. And I don't know who owes who, you know. I don't know, you know, what country owes which country, and you know, the whole idea of even going back to Vietnam as there's a term called Viet Q. It means overseas Vietnamese, but it also has kind of a pejorative tone of, you know, the sojourners, the lost ones, the ones who left, you know. And so there would be almost kind of this sense of when we came back as tourists, there was a sense of, you know, give us reparations. You
like
owe us for
thing.
This. Yeah, you know. Because now you've prospered and we're still struggling and it's tough. And so that was kind of my tacit apology to her, that song. It's like, I don't know who owes who, but I wish the very best for you.
So you've got this play coming up and it opens on Friday, right?
It opens on Friday. Yeah. First preview is actually tomorrow night. So we're going to have some audiences and we're raring to go. We're so excited. Westport Center for the Arts is co-producing with me, an amazing local organization that, has provided us with the support to be able to make it the best possible production that it can be. And yeah, it's The Butcher's Son, and I've called it a refugee play and performance memoir about my family's journey out of Vietnam to America.
So writing about your own life and your own past can be such a journey in itself. Did the experience unearth new revelations for you about your own life?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as soon as I showed the ability to write and create, my family has been pressing me about, you need to write our book. You need to write a memoir about our family's journey. And I was like 15 or 16 at the time. And I told them, no, I'm not going to do that. I'll screw it up. What, are you kidding me?
That's a great 15-year-old who knows that. Well, in press materials, Butcher's Son is described as a radio play, and it is kind of an experimental multimedia format you're working with. Can you explain that?
Sure. Yeah. So I rebuffed my parents' request to write a memoir at the age of 15, but I stuck a pin in it. You know, I stuck a pin in their request, and so I've spent the last 15 plus years, as I grew as an artist and just experienced more life as a person, I've been tackling that memoir request in the way that I knew how, and I call it actionable chunks that I could actually take action upon, you know,
instead of that phrase.
Yeah, actionable chunks, writing it a song at a time, a poem at a time, an essay at a time, a story at a time. And so after all these years, I finally realized I had enough material that I could make a show of it. Originally, I thought, you know, it would be a companion album, just a music album with the V-Tran band or V-Tran solo as a companion album to American Heroine. But it was my fiance, Mackenzie Goodwin, who is directing the show, that we were on a bus trip from Boston to New York. And she said that make it a play. Make it a play. It should be a play. And so that's what we did. And it uses spoken word poetry, slam poetry, songs and dialogue.
Thanks so much for joining me here today, V. It's been a real pleasure getting to know you. A lot of fun.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, the show opens on Wednesday, Friday. Yeah.
V-Trans play A Butcher's Son opens this Friday at the Buffalo Room in Westport. That's a venue located just across the street from the Westport Flea Market. Performances run through August 17th. We'll link to the details on our website later today.
You are the most precious bird. You are an archetypal star. Just like dear Daisy.
Now we'll hear from a performer who came to Kansas City by a very different route. Tracy Tearstrip Herber was living the dream in New York. She had a career as an actress and dancer, working as a Radio City Rockette and performing in lots of Broadway musicals. As part of our Going to Kansas City series, Tracy Tearstrip Herber talks about why she decided to move here. And she shares a reaction from a very famous friend and colleague to the news.
I remember a few days before we packed up to go, I was in the producers on Broadway. So I worked with Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane, and I remember running into Matthew on the street. And I said, I just wanted to let you know I'm moving and with my family. And he looked at me with his Ferris Bueller eyes, and he said, "What are you going to do?" I said, I don't exactly know. We'll figure it out, but I think we're ready for a change.
Unhappy, unhappy, very unhappy, unhappy, unhappy.
There's a quicker pace in New York. But when we were there and when we were in the heart of it, we were in our 20s and 30s. And there's also this big wall. There was pre-children and post-children. So we did have my daughter while we were still in New York. I mean, even having my daughter at NYU Hospital, I had her over the holidays. And I remember the doctor said, I have a Christmas party to go to. We're going to have this baby tonight. And it just was such an example of New York.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I want to be a producer, lunch at Sardi's.
We were juggling nannies with our crazy schedules. So I just had this deep-seated feeling that I needed to try something else. We both came out here on an exploratory trip early 2008. And we just looked at the skyline. The Kauffman Center was it was a ceiling. I think they had just recently done the Power and Light District, and we visited a First Friday, and we looked at each other and thought, this could be exciting. This could be something that we do together. Neither of us had ever lived in the Midwest, but we just said, let's give it a shot.
And say you, not you.
What I love now is I work with the students at the ballet and at UMKC. And yes, they will probably go on in their career to other skyscapes, to other theaters across the country. But for them to have the chance to perform on that stage as a beginning place, or some of the many theaters in this city, the smaller, intimate theaters, we don't get back to New York as much as we would like to. And yet we feel like that's okay. We got our fix here now, and we continue to feel stimulated.
Tracy Tearstrip Herber teaches acting and dance at UMKC in the Kansas City Ballet. Her story was produced by Suzanne Hogan. If you want to share your story about coming to Kansas City, we want to hear from you. And no, you don't have to be friends with Matthew Broderick. Email us at goingtokc@kcur.org. That's all the time we have for today's show. To listen back to any of this morning's conversations, just go to kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, we'll be rebroadcasting some Central Standard highlights from the past few months. You'll hear a conversation about the psychology of hatred and a talk about Ray Bradbury with the author of a new biography. Don't miss it. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross with lots of help from Matt Hodep and Christina Leffring. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today's show. Stick around for Up to Date next.